You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it from miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the Star of Rib Mountain story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? How big was the, if it is, how big is the, like, the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Seward. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers. And those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super-duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone. And it was deposited by ancient seas. And then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs: Hardwood Hill, Mozanie Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker. Those kinds of mountains, so several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away, Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Janowiak had a question about that, too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around it. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to a listener request that we discuss a global minimum tax rate. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, she announced earlier this month that a group of 132 nations now have agreed to a global minimum tax for the world's largest corporations. Do you think corporations pay too little or too much taxes in our country? Should they be punished for moving to countries with lower tax rates? It's 800-642-1234. Alexandra Reedhead is with the International Institute for Sustainable Development, headquartered in Winnipeg, Canada, and she leads its research on tax-based erosion and profit shifting in mining. Alexandra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
So all these countries, they agree to rewrite the rules for how countries tax corporate income. Why is this notable?
Well, it's notable because achieving a tentative global consensus on something like this has never been done before. So introducing a global minimum tax is a novel and important idea because the objective is really to stop the race to the bottom. So over the last 40 years, we've seen average corporate tax rates decline in every decade in every region. So back in 1980, corporate tax rates were around 40% around the world. Now in 2020, the average is 24%.
And why do they keep going lower? What is pushing them down?
I think many countries have seen tax competition or lowering their corporate tax rates as a way of attracting investment. And the idea is that investment brings jobs and growth, but actually it hasn't always amounted to that. And oftentimes we end up giving away tax revenue for uncertain benefits.
Do you know how much lost revenue that governments are failing to collect due to tax avoidance?
Yeah, it's huge. So tax havens collectively cost governments between $500 billion and $600 billion a year in lost corporate tax revenue.
What are the ramifications of that?
Well, I think the ramifications are that many countries are struggling to deliver basic social services. It's led to rising inequality in a number of countries where the rich pay very little by way of tax and the middle income group end up paying quite a lot. So we see a growth in inequality. Now with COVID, many countries are struggling to find the resources to be able to fund both the response to COVID but also the post-COVID recovery that will follow.
So as you look across the world, Alexandra, which countries have been, you know, quote unquote, winning this race to the bottom, winning this race for the lowest tax rate, if you will?
I think low tax countries or tax havens have probably been the key winners in this race. So countries that offer very low tax rates have managed to attract firms to relocate there, to take advantage of low tax rates. But that has, you know, created a whole number of negative externalities or spillover effects, if you like, for other countries that are losing tax revenue to those jurisdictions through corporate tax avoidance. So you set up in Luxembourg or the Bahamas and then you have operations elsewhere and you engage in corporate tax planning. So you shift profits out of high tax countries and transfer them to those low tax countries. And so those higher tax countries are losing out whilst those lower tax countries are winning, if you like.
And Barbados has the lowest corporate tax rate at 5.5%?
Yes, it's not alone. There are many other countries that give a run for its money. So certainly the era of tax competition and tax havens in particular has been a significant one. And now it looks like it might finally be coming to an end with a global minimum tax.
Is there a return on investment for these countries that are willing to go this low, to lower their corporate taxes? You know, how do they benefit from luring companies or multinationals and, you know, who will ultimately pay very little in taxes and yet still use all the resources?
Well, I think, you know, here it really depends on which countries we're talking about. If we're talking about places like Barbados, then you'd say, well, some of these places don't have a lot else going on. I mean, obviously tourism is important, but they don't have a lot of other industry. And so for them, you know, offering a low corporate tax rate is probably one of the you know, the best options that they have to try and attract investment into their country. And there will be some benefits from it. You know, people have to set up offices, albeit, you know, kind of makeshift letterbox offices, if you like. They have to employ some people. You might have some accountants, some lawyers relocating there in order to service those companies. So there certainly will be some benefits. And for those countries, they may not have very many options. I think, though, the issue is for perhaps less tax haven or some of those island nations, if you like, that have got fewer options, but other countries that are then forced to compete with them, where for them it's not necessarily as clear that offering tax incentives and foregoing tax revenue is a good decision. And as we see, you know, repeatedly, politicians are saying, well, if we lower corporate tax rates, then we'll attract investment, and investment delivers jobs and growth. But actually, if many of these corporations are transferring their profits offshore to low tax countries or tax havens, then we're not necessarily seeing the benefit. And as we move into an age of automation and technology, we see less jobs. And so the benefits of having that investment in the first place, I think, become less obvious, and certainly the cost in terms of the tax revenue that's foregone become more obvious and more problematic, particularly in the era that we live in off the back of the global financial crisis and now COVID. Countries have agreed that tax competition has to stop. They can't afford to continue to forego these vital tax revenues to multinational companies. And it's ultimately multinational companies that are winning here. I mean, tax havens are also benefiting, but it's the multinationals that are the clear winners.
Well, let's go to Ivy now in Evansville with thoughts on the corporate tax rate. Ivy, hi.
Hi. I just think that paying taxes is the cost of doing business. My grandfather, who owned an engineering firm in the 50s and 60s, my brother and I discovered his taxes, and he paid nearly 50%. I believe that these corporations benefit from our infrastructure, the security around doing business. I mean, none of their trucks are hijacked off the road, and all the things that make it possible for them to function well in our country. And so they need to contribute. And to me, it's egregious that Exxon, with an economy larger than Rhode Island, pays no taxes in our country. Anyway, that's my opinion. My grandfather did pay almost 50%.
Ivy, thank you. Yeah, thank you for bringing that observation and the history there with your grandfather. Alexandra.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with Ivy. Absolute agreement. And I think that's right. I mean, tax rates haven't always been this low. In fact, tax rates have typically been much higher, as Ivy said. You know, as I said, back in the 1980s, we're talking about a global average corporate tax rate of around 40%. And so what we've seen over this period is just this massive decline in corporate tax rates as countries scramble to try and attract investment. And where they've got to now at the end of that is, well, was that really worth it after all? And I think, you know, obviously there are some examples of where incentives have been effective at attracting investment, but they're often very limited, and they're kind of the opposite of that, where incentives have been deeply ineffective and deeply damaging and harmful are more common. So I agree that, companies have paid higher tax rates in the past than they can pay higher tax rates. It is a cost of doing business. And so it's really exciting to see that countries have agreed to come together around an issue as important as this.
And we're going to talk more about this plan as we discuss a global minimum tax on corporations and the so-called race to the bottom and what it means for world economies. Alexandra Reedhead, she's an analyst with the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Are you in favor of treaties that would create global standards for taxing corporations, or would you rather the U.S. avoid binding treaties? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alexandra Reedhead here on the Ideas Network.
Is
It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the prospects of a minimum global tax rate for multinationals. At their meeting in London last month, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced G7 finance ministers had made a commitment to a global minimum tax at a rate of at least 15%.
That global minimum tax would end the race to the bottom in corporate taxation and ensure fairness for the middle class and working people in the U.S. and around the world.
How would you like countries to cooperate? Is it possible? What ideas do you have for getting companies to pay their fair share in taxes? 800-642-1234. Alexander Reedhead is the tax lead in the International Institute for Sustainable Development with us for about eight more minutes. Alexandra, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, is negotiating here, putting this plan together. What is this agency?
Well, the OECD is a global organization representing developed economies, essentially. So many of the developed economies participate in the OECD. The OECD provides policy advice and assistance on a huge range of matters, including tax.
And so how would they carry out this plan? How would it work across the world?
Right. So the OECD, as part of its mandate to work on taxation, has formed what is called the Inclusive Framework. And the Inclusive Framework is made up of 135 member countries. And that group has agreed at the political level to implement a global minimum tax. So whilst the OECD is just an organization, it represents a handful of countries worldwide. By forming this inclusive framework, they've broadened, expanded their mandate, and this is going to be key to implementing this proposal. But what they've agreed to is a global minimum tax on corporate profits. So this means that the global profits of a multinational corporation with an annual turnover of more than 750 million euros will be taxed at least at a minimum effective tax rate. So that tax rate is going to be calculated on a country-by-country basis, which means that each entity that's part of the multinational group must pay at least the globally agreed rate in each of the jurisdictions where they're based. So as you said, at this stage, the tax rate looks likely to be 15%, but the next meeting will take place in October, and we'll hear more then. What this means is if that one of the entities within that group pays less than the agreed rate of tax to its host country, then the home country where the parent is headquartered collects the difference between the subsidiary's effective tax rate and the global minimum tax. So there's nowhere to hide, right? So you're a multinational, you've got operations in a lot of different jurisdictions. In each of those places, you have to pay at least 15%. And if you don't pay, then the country where the multinational is headquartered has the right to collect the difference, to pick up what we call the top-up tax. So it effectively tries to eliminate tax competition.
So is it true that China and India want like carve-outs to protect preferred industries? What would be some exemptions to this minimum corporate tax?
Yes, so there have been discussions around carve-outs, and this is one of the challenges, I think, between now when this political agreement has been reached in October and following in the following months in terms of agreeing the technical details. So a lot of countries have already started to lobby for carve-outs. For example, a carve-out has been agreed for the financial services sector. I think certain countries like France, for example, are lobbying to protect their research and development tax credits. So certainly we'll see now, over the next few months, countries start to come up and say, well, you know, what about this tax incentive that I have? I'd really like to keep that. Is there any way we could kind of protect that or carve it out of this deal so it's not included in the calculation of the minimum effective tax rate?
We're talking with Alexandra Reedhead, who works for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Let's go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you. How do nonprofits get taxed? We have these behemoth healthcare systems, at least in our area, who are nonprofits.
Alexandra, what would be the impact on a nonprofit?
Well, a nonprofit isn't going to be impacted by these rules. So really, this is about profit-making entities that generate taxable income. So really, we're talking about some of the world's biggest multinational companies, you know, the Amazons, the Googles, and so on. So you have to be over a certain threshold in terms of your annual revenue for the tax to apply to you. So I think for the most part, this won't apply to nonprofits, but certainly, as you say, Jim, that's another area of concern, making sure that, you know, all organizations pay a reasonable share of tax. I think for nonprofit organizations, the situation is more complex, obviously, because they're working in the public good and they're not necessarily generating income or any profit. So, but it is important that their staff, for example, are subject to normal personal income tax regimes and the like.
So when you talk about the Amazons and the Googles of the world, if you will, how would closing these cross-border tax loopholes affect the tech world, affect tech companies?
Well, at some level, it will raise the cost of doing business, as Ivy mentioned earlier. Now, at this point, companies like Amazon and Google, these tech companies can often operate remotely, so they don't necessarily have a presence, a physical presence in a country where they have sales. And so as a result, they don't pay any tax there because in the past, you know, you only pay tax where you have a physical presence. And so by avoiding that, they are also able to avoid tax. So going forward under these new rules, that won't be possible. And they will be, you know, multinational companies will be subject to some level of tax everywhere that they operate or everywhere that they have business activity.
In our last couple moments together here, what obstacles do you see for finding international agreement on this really difficult issue?
Well, the fact that we've made it this far is very promising. That we can reach a political agreement on this is, yeah, as I said, unprecedented to see this level of international cooperation on taxation. However, there's a lot of details to be worked out. So as we discussed, many countries may begin to request exemptions or carve-outs. Of course, some countries didn't sign on to the deal, and that includes, for example, some low-tax European countries like Ireland,
Estonia, Hungary.
Which will prove problematic.
Yeah.
Exactly, prove problematic for getting an EU law passed, which is going to be important to implementing a global tax in Europe.
Alexandra, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Alexandra Reedhead, she is with the International Institute for Sustainable Development, where she leads the Institute's research on tax-based erosion and profit shifting in mining. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.